Well, it is my distinct pleasure and honor to introduce Mike Bazzaniga to you. And by the way, before they take that award away, take a little gander past it. We're just very, very pleased to give you our Lifetime Achievement Award for all the great contributions you've made. I should give you a few of the usual statistics. We've invited him here, of course, as Chuck said, on behalf of the Law, Psychology, and Human Development Program, also the Center for Behavioral Economics and Decision Research, and last but not least, our own Human Development, Human Neuroscience Institute. So welcome on behalf of many, many entities, including the law school. He's director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at University of California, Santa Barbara. He received his PhD from Caltech, where he worked with Roger Sperry of Split Brain fame. And he initiated a whole bunch of fascinating research that's influenced all of us with him, as well as with Dave Premack, George Miller, and many other luminaries. Now, it's not often you can say that you're going to see someone who actually created a field. He was a founder of the Cognitive Neuroscience Society. He was a founder of the MacArthur Foundation Law and Neuroscience Program, which continues to give us dividends today and has influenced, I know, my work and many, many others. He was a founder of the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. I could go on and on. And he's only 35. I'm going to talk to you today about how embryos can publish. I think that's what that's about. Anyway, it's incredible, and I want to just, and he's going to talk to you too about a forthcoming book. He's a member, you know, the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences. I could, you know, as I mentioned to him, I was getting a little bit of an arm ache carrying his Vita, you know, over here. So there's many, many other things I could mention, but he certainly has had a direct influence on my work, on just about everybody who's working in cognitive neuroscience, because if it wasn't for him, there wouldn't be an area to work in. And not only that, the details of the kind of work, the unconscious processing, distributed modules in the brain, many ideas that we take for granted really started with him. And also I wanted to say on a personal note, I met Mike many years ago when I was a student about the age of many of the people in this room. And he was very gracious to me, and it was just inspiring when I was a student to interact with him and to watch him and George Miller create a field together, and the excitement that engendered in all of us students, that we felt we really were on the frontier of new knowledge, and it sort of worked out. It's panned out very nicely. And I want to thank him for being so gracious to me then, and so gracious to me recently when he invited me to be a SAGE Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Mind. So I really appreciate that, and Mike Miller, and all the support that he's given us, and it has definitely improved our own facility here, the Cornell Magnetic Resonance Imaging Facility. Thank you for your guidance on that and helping set that up. So in his intellectual autobiography in the annual review, which I highly recommend that you read, it's a fun read, he's a wonderful writer, but he refers to Roger Sperry as the man. He met the man. And today, I'd like to say, we've met the man, and now he's the man. Thank you very much.
I thought I'd sort of give a case history of an experience I had where I was on the President's Council on Bioethics, Bush's Council on Bioethics, and how being dropped into that made me aware of the need to cross-communicate complex topics across professional lines, bringing together scientists, lawyers, philosophers, politicians, and the like. And how do you do that? Well, when I did this, started in 2002, I guess it was, I had no idea. I was just sort of dropped into this chore, and I was happy up at Dartmouth. I had my job there. I had gone to school there, and the two buildings there, the Baker Library, is where Dartmouth tries to teach you how to think. And the other building there is the Alpha Delta Animal House, where I learned all my heuristics over there as giraffe. But Dartmouth, as you know, is a rural New England, but it's easier. I had to do this. It's easier to get to than here. So anyway. So I'm sitting there one day, and Leon Cass, the distinguished bioethicist from University of Chicago, head of the Social Committee on Social Thought there, had been appointed by Bush to head up this committee on bioethics. And he called, and he was about the executive order that Bush had given to form a council that should advise the president on bioethical issues that may emerge as a consequence of advances in biomedical science and technology. That's fairly broad scope, but he alerted me to the fact that there were going to be many hot button issues, and the first one was really going to be on stem cells, which, if you can roll back to 2001, 2002, it was an extremely hot issue. And he was explaining this, and there's no explanation at the time, just give you the full experience here. There's no explanation at the time of who else is on the committee. You don't know. You're just being called. Do you want to serve on it? There was no interest in my politics. What are you? No interest, zero, no questions ever asked. It was just, you know, does this sound like an interesting thing to do? And I said, but I'm not a bioethicist. I don't know. And he made the point that the committee was about bioethics, but it wasn't composed of bioethicists. People there were representing various aspects of the society that want to think about these questions. And the original committee was full of interesting people. Liz Blackburn, James Q. Wilson, Michael Sandel, you can see there, Frank Fukuyama, Janet Rowley, Mary Glendon for the lawyers in town, Robbie George, just a bunch of people. And the only person I knew was Paul McHugh when the list finally came out and we found out who was on it. And so we all showed up, and I didn't know, nor did I think anybody knew where this was all going to land. But right away, we were thrown into the topic of stem cell science. And again, because I'm trying to do a lot of this for the students and what you think of, what we should come to know may be your duties, to accept a position on any of these committee meetings is a serious commitment of time. So over 7 years, those are two-day meetings, which is a little longer. You fly to Washington. And if you come from Ithaca, my God, I can't think of the amount of time it takes to get there. But it's tremendously consuming and an important commitment for which there's no compensation. And in addition to that, it's all the reading material that you get beforehand. So these are not free, easy assignments. They take time and they're hard work. And I think that's important to know. Secondly, the kinds of issues that we studied were many over the 7 years. And I'm going to talk about the stem cell one because it's a particularly interesting case history that brings together all kinds of issues. Another one that I spent a lot of time on was the determinism and law issue, which we won't talk about today. I wrote up a little book called The Ethical Brain, which kind of went through these things and laid it out and from the perspective of a neuroscientist looking at these questions. And for those interested in the real bioethics history and everything, I just wanted to recommend Johnson's book. It's really a wonderful book. So how important, how esoteric, I mean, you look at determinism, free will, and those kinds of questions, is that just kind of, you know, college bull sessions kind of thing? Well, the Vatican, the Pontifical Academy of Science a year and a half ago had a meeting on that very topic. And the people at the meeting you can't see them there, I'm sorry, with the photograph, but there's all the psychologists, everybody here knows these psychologists. There's Liz Spelke, Mike Posner, Stan Dehane, Tim Wilson, Svante Paabo's there, Wolf Singer, all these kind of people were going there talking about the implications of deterministic science and on free will. And it was amazing to see that this was, this concerns great and large and influential institutions in the world, and they want to know about it. And someone, my wife pointed out to me, someone said, well, did you have any impact on the Vatican? And the only thing I can say is that the Pope resigned shortly after our meeting. So here's the real challenge, though. You're now at the meeting, you're now at the council, and you're about to begin. And the first thing you quickly learn is that there's all kinds of religious beliefs. There are humanists, there are pragmatists, there are scientists, there's physicians, there are lawyers, there's philosophers. What you have to develop a common language, because if you let the scientists go off on their thing, people get lost real fast. So the details of stem cell biology are complex. How do you represent it at what level so that people can get an understanding of what's going on? And so too, a legal analysis of a bioethical issue is complex, and it seems obscure to people who just have sort of a general intellectual understanding. Incidentally, in 2001, it's interesting that even biologists, while they knew what a stem cell was, they couldn't really, the man on the street biologists, they couldn't really tell you what the stem cell thing was. So it's an interesting moment where you realize, actually, this is being discussed, and you're supposed to be discussing it from a point of knowledge. How do you do it? What's going on? And then you quickly learn, of course, that as Ralph Waldo Emerson pointed out, we are belief machines. Everybody in that room was jam-packed with beliefs, heartfelt beliefs about this and that. And how do you change people's beliefs? How do you even get a discussion going when they're opposing beliefs in the room? And we all know from psychology, of course, the work of Leon Festinger and his example of when religious beliefs, when prophecy fails. But also, you know, scientists aren't so great at changing their mind either. In neuroscience, Cajal and Golgi had a famous misunderstanding. Camille Golgi was the guy that invented the stain that showed there's a neuron. But Golgi had this mindset that it was all what he called a synctium. It was just all this web, that these little things were part of a web. And it was Cajal who, years later, looking at a Golgi slide, said, aha, that's a neuron, a single unit. And it's Cajal that is credited with the neuron doctrine that we live by today. So because Golgi, the man who invented it, saw it for the first time, had it for years, he had this other belief. He couldn't see what was in front of him. And the same story goes famously for Kepler. And just a note in passing, we're being visited at Santa Barbara now by Gerd Gigerinzer on the issue of medical statistics. And you can just see another one where the reality is one thing, the beliefs are another, and how to get those two things together is going to be a major chore. So let's look at the issue of cloning. This is the case history I want to tell you about. Oh, there is water here. Is this water?
Yes, it is.
So we all know about Dolly. And we know, therefore, that reproductive cloning works. Now, just a little quick Bio 1 course here. What is cloning? Well, as it will ultimately be discussed in terms of the human condition, you basically take an egg, an oocyte, from a woman, and you enucleate it, take the DNA out, and then you take a cell from the person who you want to clone, and it can be, I could go over to anybody in the front row there and just scrape with their skin with my fingernail. I've got millions of cells that I can now take any one of those, plop it in that egg, do this wunderbar magic, which no one knows what's going on there, but it works. So much of biology is that, right? It works, let's use it, right? So the wunderbar biology, and bingo, you can take that thing all the way down and you can wind up with a baby. So that's reproductive cloning, or cloning for baby making, as the phrase became. And was the world ready for that? Was that going to go anywhere? And pretty much the entire council said no. It's first of all, it's too risky. We know there's all kinds of issues we don't know about cloning in terms of long-term health issues. Other people just didn't like it because it wasn't a natural way to make a baby. There's got to be something in there that's going to be a surprise. And a lot of people had the religious belief that humans don't make babies. Babies are made by supernatural forces and they're a gift. So for all those reasons, it all added up that, no cloning for reproductive purposes. And there were lots of things, like the Harvard and Yale couple get married, they're out for dinner one night, ready to have kids, and the Harvard guy says, you didn't get into Harvard, so let's clone me. And can you imagine how that discussion would go? I mean, we tried to keep it light like that, but the fact of the matter is, it was just off the table, okay? Then there is biomedical cloning, and here's where all the issues become tense, focused, and are important. And it's basically the same thing. You take an oocyte, an egg from a woman, you nucleate it, you get a cell from somebody who, say, needs a liver, and you want to grow them one. But what? Just roll back. You take the oocyte, you take the cell, you plug it in, and you grow it up in a petri dish to 14 days, as seen there. And about that time, and you harvest it. You harvest the stem cells out of that. That's called a blastocyst, and you can get about 150 stem cells or so. And those stem cells then are plated out, and they're ready to become anything. They're pluripotent cells. They can become a liver, a brain tissue, what have you. And that is an exciting extension for regenerative medicine, the possible things medical science can achieve with repair. Now, that seems fine. Well, of course, the issue is that blastocyst could also be reimplanted into a uterus, even an artificial uterus, and become a baby. So you are killing human life, and that should be protected. If you're of certain persuasions or religious beliefs or not, just you believe all human life has a circle drawn around it and it's to be protected. And so the debates range that the moral status of this cells there has the same moral status as an adult living their life. And so now the question is, that's the issue on the table. You have physicians, you have scientists, you have lawyers, you have philosophers, you have people committed to various religious points of view. How are you going to talk about it? And so the argument after the first sort of discussions of the actual biology, which I've obviously shorthanded there, one of the main arguments was, well, the blastocyst has the potential. This is the potentiality, Margaret, that because it can be a human, if certain things happen to it, it is protected both morally and legally. And so an analogy came up during the discussion that I tried to push, which was, well, Home Depot has all of the components for making a house. And when Home Depot burns down, it's not that 30 homes burn down. You can get about 30 homes out of a Home Depot. But that, in fact, Home Depot burnt down. The interactions haven't started yet. It's not another thing yet. So that was one argument that people tried to buffer the notion that there was something awful about this blastocyst being used for stem cell development. You know, these are discussions and metaphors and so forth that everybody can get in and talk about. It crosses all their professional lines, they get it, and then they can talk about the veracity of it or lack of it, depending on their point of view. The slippery slope argument. Well, if we allow this 14-day thing, and then it's going to be 22, and then it's going to, and then pretty soon, you know, it gets right up into a late-stage abortion. And, you know, is that, so we can't have any of this stuff. We're just going to say it's that conception, and that's the end of it. So we had many a discussion about, well, the slippery slope argument. We've got all kinds of slippery slopes, and that's why we have a legal system to draw lines, and people have to adhere to those lines, and so forth and so on. It's a doable thing. We as a human culture can do this. That discussion ensues. All these are going around for 6 months, right? Whether they're having an impact or not, we don't know yet. Then there was the transplantation model. So this is a big issue. You roll the camera back. Can you take an organ and transplant it to another person? So can you take a heart out of someone who's brain dead and give it to somebody who needs it? And, you know, you got to get the scene here. Somebody's in the emergency, somebody comes in and they're declared brain dead. Their heart's still beating, right? And this means a surgeon is cracking their chest, taking this beating heart out of this person, and then going over to the next table and implanting it into the person who needs the heart. And you just say, oh, yeah, that's what we do now. But I just remember when I started to think about this stuff, I said, wow, it turns out my brother does that for a living. So I call him up and I said, does that ever give you pause that you're going in there and you're ripping this heart out? And he says, what? No, that person is dead, irreversibly dead, no coming back. And this person you're going to give many, many years of life to. So what allowed that to be socially acceptable? Well, it turned out it was a letter from Pope Pius XII. And to the New England Journal of Medicine, broke the ice on that. And all of a sudden, transplantations were okay in Western medicine and, of course, continue and have saved hundreds of thousands a year. So we can take organs from brain-dead people and use them for a biomedical purpose. So I raised the question, well, blastocysts don't even have a brain. There's no brain in that 14-day oath. It hasn't even started to develop yet. It's a hunk of cells that can be liver, kidney, brain, and all that. So will that truth have an impact on people's thinking? And then finally, the argument that presented by gynecological researchers, which was shocking to everybody in the room, didn't know this one, that 30 to 80% in normal sexual union have spontaneous abortions, basically. Spontaneous loss of fertilized embryos. So then there's the issue of twinning. So, because you get it right into conception, there's this God-made entity, but then wait, for 14 days there can be twinning. So you made one mind, and then wait a minute, then you split it into two. How does that go theologically? And then there's the chimera. After that, the chimera, the twinning can reunite back into one. And so, again, these are. This is a charged room where people are trying to talk together, and they're bringing up these puzzles. And everybody's exchanging. You don't know where it's going yet. It's just a discussion. And so we got through all that. And this is kind of one of the first points I want to make, is pretty soon, where you're playing the role of a scientist, I was a neuroscientist, and you're asked to talk about the nervous system and development and blah, blah. And pretty soon, you just, some points crystallize in your mind, and I kind of just mentioned them. So I wrote a piece, an op-ed piece for the New York Times. In my mind at the time, as just simply spelling out the issue as I saw it, right? It's an op-ed piece. What I didn't fully realize is that I had slipped into advocacy. And what you're doing when you're explaining as a scientifically trained lawyer, or what a lot of you will be doing, is it's more than just arguing a point. You're actually advocating whether you want to or not. I'm not an advocate, but it turns out I was an advocate because of this role that you take on. And I just want the students to fully appreciate that. So anyway, I wrote this thing in the op-ed, and then soon thereafter, William Safire, in fact, in May, got wind of this committee, and he was, for some reason, very interested in this question. And so he wrote in the Times, well, there seems to be a little agitation on the committee. It doesn't look like a pushover. Everybody thought this committee was just going to fold, be against cloning of all types, and that was going to be the end of it. But there was obviously something brewing. And he said, if the he points out there in this article that if the anti-cloning, if there had been an anti-cloning majority, the committee would have reported out in May of that year. But because no one could override the 60-vote rule in the Senate, the committee I was on did not take a stand in May. Okay. They finally didn't take a stand in May, basic way of saying that. So here's the committee again, reshuffled in this slide, and kind of shuffled to where they stood. So the committee, the six people on the right, seven people on the right there, were against cloning of both types, biomedical and reproductive and biomedical. Mm-hmm. The seven people on the left were against reproductive cloning, but for giving the green light to biomedical cloning with regulations. Everything has to be regulated. You got to get your regulatory boards. You're going to do stuff like this. But morally, no problem. Go ahead and do it. And three people in the middle were for against reproductive. Everybody's against reproductive cloning. But they have no problem with the moratorium, but they wanted a moratorium until the regulations were written. They were just kind of a little bit more specific. But you add it all up, and here's what we were asked to do, and in a response. So the choice was at the June Council, possibility three, it was called, ban on cloning to produce children with regulation, permission, but under regulation of the use of cloned human embryos for biomedical research. Option three, ban plus regulation. And then option six was, let's make it, was ban everything, okay? Now, how this was, and so if you look at it that way, there are really 10 declarations to go ahead with biomedical cloning, but with regulations. And there were seven people opposed to it. So what happened in July, 1 month later after the June meeting, was this came out as seven for a complete ban, seven support biomedical research with regulation, and three support biomedical but with moratorium until regulations in place, right? How did that all get translated? Reported as 10 voted for moratorium, right? This was all done in the press. If you actually go look at the websites and the data, you'll see that it's quite clear, just as I portrayed it. And the notion why this was allowed was that they needed time to talk up the ban. The people who, the seven, wanted the moratorium so they can convince everybody else just to ban that too. And the three wanted, agreed to the word moratorium because they just wanted the time for the regulations to be in place. So, as I said, the New York Times wrote it up a little bit in favor of it. It looked like they were for the 10 were opposed, were for a moratorium. And the bottom here was a quote from the president's, the White House. Despite the divisions on the panel, a senior administrative official called the report consistent with the president's core view, which is majority opinion, clearly rejects the position of those who say we should ban reproductive cloning this year while authorizing research cloning. Geez, you got to read the fine print. And so, which I said, huh? What's all that? You know. And yet, that's how it works. And everything here I'm saying, there's nothing told out of school here. It's all part of the public record, and yet it's all spun in these very interesting and complex ways. Now, all of this is also to say and that the embryo issue is a hot issue. It gets people going faster than you can say boo. People care about this issue. The culture cares about it. And so it is not something to be, oh, well, you know, that should be dismissed as an overriding issue. No. You're missing, everyone is missing the point if they don't accept this as a hot issue. So scientists, you know, got to work on this. Maybe how can we get around this problem? And various people made other suggestions for how biomedical cloning could go forward. What about discarded embryos? There are people that have embryos that are frozen and then they decide not to use them. Couldn't we use those for stem cells? That was one argument. Another one was making an artifact that could not be human. This was a kind of the bizarre one. Is create something new that isn't human but can do all the human biology for you. That didn't go anywhere. When you're at the eight cell stage, just take out a cell and use that for your cloning purposes because the other cells will instantly come back and you'll have a normal development of the remaining seven cells. And then the one that seemed, you know, everybody understood it, but it just seemed wild, dedifferentiation. That's where you take a cell and run it backwards in time to where when it's a stem cell, stop it, or a pluripotent cell, stop it, and then use it for whatever you want, whether kidney, heart, lung. So you get that dedifferentiation, just go, come back in time before the thing differentiates out. Everybody thought that was kind of a zany idea, too, right? But, you know, it made sense biologically. So while all that was being discussed, right afterwards, there was a Brownback bill, ban all cloning. The issues were hot. They were everywhere. And then in 2006, President Bush in his State of the Union came on again, brought the whole thing up again. Tonight I ask you to pass legislation to prohibit the most egregious abuse of medical research, human cloning in all its forms, creating or implanting embryos for experiments, creating human-animal hybrids, and buying, selling, or patenting human embryos. Human life is a gift from our Creator, and that gift should never be discarded, devalued, or put up for sale. Well, that's a heartfelt position that roughly 96% of the people in the world believe. And so, you know, what do you do? How, you know, come out, some point's being missed here. And so what I thought was, I hit the news wires again. I wrote another op-ed for the New York Times, and I tried to change the argument that, what does it mean to be human? What are we talking about here? Are we talking about this DNA molecule? Is that human? Or is human life, human mentation, all the things that we respect and love, is it something else? And so so what I wanted to do was, maybe if we got people focused away from these simple potentiality and that the notion that DNA in and of itself is equivalent, has a moral equivalence of a human mentating creature, that maybe we could get people thinking differently. And so, putting aside the belief in the creator, the vast majority of the world's population is taking some of that, what is it, issue is how we are to define human life. And I argue, look around you, look at your loved ones, do you see a hunk of cells or do you see something else? And of course, what is it we all do? We map agency onto everything. We map agency onto every human being. And I kind of argue in a sense that we're all dualists. When I talk to you, at some level I know it's my brain talking to your brain, but your brain's talking to my brain, but that's not how we think of it. We have this other abstraction mechanism that allows us to give agency to the other person and to ourselves. And that's not present, I promise you, in a Petri dish, right? That's not what we should do. And we do it, you know, as been pointed out for years, we map agency onto COG here, this robot, early robot at MIT. We see something with its eyes moving, that's something alive in there. When in the awful end-of-life, brain-dead situations, the reason this mother has such a hard time letting go is her baby is moving her eyes, and that clicks in her model of who her baby is, her daughter is, because that's what we do for everybody. We have a model of the other person in our head, and anything that triggers that model, that person is as alive in that mind as you can imagine. And to invade that with another realization is very tough. So what I wanted to argue and see if we could get going is that thing in a Petri dish is something else. It doesn't yet have memories and project love and hopes and so forth. And we are the accumulation of human experience embedded in our hardware. We're not simply the hardware. You know, when your computer fails, you don't really care about the motherboard going down. You care about all the memories that are in there, all the stuff that you've encoded in there for your use. And the notion to just equate human uniqueness and wonder with a DNA molecule, we just had that wrong. Let's move on and think about other things. Well, life goes on. 2006, Shinji Yamanaka figures out how to de-differentiate, reprogram a cell. Amazing. This is what is so great about science, you know? Everybody, yada-da-da-da-da, oh, you can't do that. Somebody just goes to work the next morning and keeps at it and figures it out. So Yamanaka figured out how to put four genes in a test tube with a diploid cell and reprogram those babies back to be pluripotent cells, induce pluripotent cells, iPSCs, IPS to call them. And what's interesting is, so he figured out how to do this, and this was considered a great breakthrough to solve the moral dilemma, because you now were not discarding an embryo. Now what you were doing to get those pluripotent cells, instead of making an embryo and then harvesting the blastocysts and so forth and destroying a potential, you're taking a cell from an adult and you're reprogramming it backwards. You're not, there's no chance in some sense of becoming a human. So you're not, you've obviated this deep moral conflict that many people have. So So iPS cells are all over the place now. They're very powerful, they're very important, they're very used. But the story isn't older, it isn't done yet. So this is, I don't need to go through this. So what happens is that, of course, with enough science known, there's some problems with these iPS cells. They may be carrying genetic information that may be detrimental, that may be expressed in the animals that can be produced from the stem cells generated by this. And all of the complex science that you might think goes on is going on. And so there's some caution about iPS cells, and there's going to have to be a lot of work done before they're freely used in the biomedical cloning context. And these are just some of them. So there's another issue that, given the law and science and psychology here, that no one has really emphasized. So as I said to you, we went, the standard is for somatic cell nuclear transfer. You take the oocyte and you put the nucleus from the person you want biomedical cloning cells for, and you let it develop, and then you get stem cells, and then you get possible repair for heart. But then if it goes all the way, it can be an embryo, and that's the moral dilemma. Well, you know, it's also true that in reprogramming, you're just running the tape backwards, but you got the same problem. You could say, well, wait a minute, we're going to just run it back to pluripotent cells, but you could run it all the way back to stem cells and then totipotent cells, and you're not allowing that to happen, but you could. So does that offer a moral dilemma? So people talk about that. And then finally, just show how fast moving this, all these things are going on while there's a science that is vigorous and progressing on these issues. And now they have come back, just reported in the last few months, to induce pluripotent cells were the big theme for the last 6 years. Now they're coming back to the somatic cell nuclear transfer technique and seeing how to do it in human cells, in both embryonic cells and also in adult cells. So nowhere is this argument just going to go away. Nowhere is the tension and debate of this going to go away. It takes constant monitoring, constant changing because of the changing science, because of the values of society. It's a very complex issue. And one just has to see in the last year in the Supreme Court, there was a big to-do about the various new bills that were before the House, and it's just an ever-present issue. So here's the final thing. Continuing constant communication is necessary in these ethical issues that involve science and involve psychology, involve human development, involve the law. And one thing you got to recognize is you can't change a religious belief. Just do not go there. You can change understanding what it means to be human, I think. If people learn to understand what you really mean by that, it may alter how they think at the edges. And important science writing that engages the public, publicly, just this fair warning that you just think you're playing the role of the explainer, but you become, in that context, an advocate. And you should just be ready for it and understand that that's almost unavoidable, given the nature of societal knowledge on this without that explanation. And so finally, you just realize that you're wound up with advocacy by explanation. So it's a powerful tool. Students who will go off into the world with these skills will have a wonderful opportunity to play this role, and I look forward to it because you need sophisticated training in these things. You can't wing it like I did for 6 years. Thank you.